I tear those mountains down.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I am Joe Clement, your host today. The Old Mole is your radical political magazine for the airwaves. We bring you interviews, reviews, music, commentary, weird, different kinds of things to jolt your senses, to lift your spirits, and to make you think. On today's show, Bill Resnick is going to be talking with union activist and lawyer Steve Early about the police and his experiences in Richmond, California, and with the Richmond Progressive Alliance, getting reform brought to their department. Later in the show, Jan Hocken will be talking with student activist Annika Main about Juliana versus United States, which is a lawsuit that a bunch of kids were going to bring, are trying to bring against the government, suing them to take action on climate change. That was supposed to begin today on the 29th in an Oregon district court, but it was stalled by the Supreme Court, and they're going to be talking about a rally to protest this stalling and to support the kids and the environment ultimately. And later in the show, Denise Morris and I will be reviewing the weird 1980s horror film Society. It's about how the rich really are different. But we're going to begin today's show with Bill Resnick and Steve Early.
Steve Early, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me on again, Bill.
For many years, Steve Early worked as a labor journalist. His books and articles, like A New Labor Movement for the New Century, they were very influential with activists fighting the good fight for union democracy, rank and file activism, and put the movement back into the labor movement. He's now also writing on politics, recently published the book Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City. Rich and California, mostly working class, mostly people of color, where Steve lived. That's the remake city that Steve wrote about. Part of that remaking came with a great uprising, electoral and movement building through the Richmond Progressive Alliance to transform the police and policing in that city. Steve Early is very active in the Progressive Alliance and all its struggles. So, Steve, tell us about the Richmond Progressive Alliance, how they gained power, why they tackled police reform right away.
Well, as I recount in the book that you mentioned, Refinery Town, progressives in Richmond started running for city council and mayor 14 years ago and began having increasing success. For 8 years, our city was the largest in the country with a green mayor, Gail McLaughlin, who was one of the founding members of the Richmond Progressive Alliance. And over time, she was joined by others on the city council to the point where we now have a progressive supermajority. Five RPA members out of seven members of the city council. You know, Richmond is a city that historically had high levels of street crime and violence, problems with gangs and drug dealing and shootings. So public safety was an issue that progressives, once they gained city hall influence, had to grapple with. And they did that by working with the city manager to hire a very effective police chief by the name of Chris Magnus, who was now nationally known as a police reformer and proponent of community policing. And over a 10-year period, under Magnus's leadership, the composition of the police department was greatly diversified, the culture of policing changed, and relations between police and the community, both in day-to-day interactions and in policing of public demonstrations and protests, was greatly improved. The level of public safety now is much higher than it was before, to the point where in this year's election for mayor, a candidate on the left running against the incumbent Liberal Democrat has actually proposed that there be cuts in spending on the police and that funds now be diverted to other city programs that might help change some of the conditions that produce crime and violence and cause us to need a fully staffed police department.
Let's talk a little bit about the changing the police, their behavior, the way they operate in the community, their goals, and also their commitment to sort of constitutional government and respect for the citizen. It seems to me that Richmond shows the way.
Well, when Chris Magnus, who was our police chief for more than 10 years, took over in 2005, Richmond very much had a police department that operated on the all-too-common military model. The police were viewed by many residents of this 80% non-white city as being an occupying army. The police department at that time used street teams in high-crime neighborhoods. They swept people up. They hassled people. There was a lot of stop and frisk activity. So the first step in the process of police reform was to really redefine the role of a police officer. Chief Magnus assigned a lot more officers to regular beats, told them that they were going to be evaluated and their career advancement would be dependent on their ability to build productive, constructive, long-term relationships with individual residents and neighborhood groups and community leaders. The police were redeployed in ways that supported civilian efforts to reduce gang violence and drug trafficking and human trafficking in Richmond. Police began to work much more constructively with churches and youth groups and all kinds of nonprofit organizations. So over time, people began to view the police as allies in the struggle to make Richmond safer and healthier as a city, not as the enemy. The level of crime and violence was greatly reduced, many fewer homicides, and Richmond has only had two officer-involved fatal shootings in the last 14 years.
In some cities, community policing was just used for snitching. You get people to tell on their neighbors and then invade the neighbor's house. How do you make sure that this community policing actually reflects respect for people and isn't, in fact, part of a right-wing sort of suppressive effort?
Well, you do have to diversify the police force itself. And when Chief Magnus took over in 2005, the Richmond Police Department was not as representative of the diversity of the community as it is today. And so one of the things he did was encourage some early retirements, people who did not want to be part of a changed police department culture. And he was able to hire over time many more women, many more police officers from minority backgrounds, and some who were Richmond residents and were willing to live in Richmond in the community that they serve. One of the challenges we know is that about 20% of all police officers in the country have military backgrounds. And sometimes that's not a problem in terms of their individual behavior. Other times it's a big problem because studies have shown that police officers who are veterans, particularly of recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, have a greater tendency to use firearms, to be the subject of police brutality complaints, and to have other problems on the job that may be the result of service-related conditions acquired while serving overseas. So sometimes hiring people, for example, from military backgrounds who've been part of an occupying army in foreign countries is not the best way to reorient how police departments function in cities where we need to get away from that model of policing relating to the community.
Right. And you also had a real independent review board and, in fact, disciplining of police and forcing those police out.
Very definitely. In Richmond, we have two mechanisms for that. One of the big complaints about the police many places is that when there's a police brutality incident, it's cops investigating cops. Internal affairs investigations are conducted by the police department itself. Richmond's one of the few cities that has what's called an Office of Professional Accountability. It's headed by a civilian. It's located in City Hall, and that's the arm of city government that investigates complaints about police misconduct. These are not internal affairs investigations anymore. They're independent ones. And in one recent case, the independent investigator recommended the firing of an officer and the suspension and demotion and reprimand of about eight others. We also have a civilian police review commission that has the power to hire its own independent investigator and subpoena cops and require them to testify and initiate investigations even where there haven't been civilian complaints. So there's two layers of oversight outside the department.
Steve, do you believe that with all of that, have the police really changed or are they just complying? Is there an actual commitment, in fact, to a very different model of policing and to respect for constitutional rights?
Well, I think you're generalizing by about a department of city government that employs 180 to 200 people, consumes 60% of the city budget, which is, one of the issues being debated right now. Is that too much, too little? and we afford cuts in police staffing to invest more in other city programs. Police department's not perfect. No arm of city government here or anywhere else is. It's composed of human beings who make mistakes and come to their jobs with all kinds of personal and political baggage. But I think overall, you know, the culture has changed for the better. And surveys of Richmond residents show that people view the police much more positively here, certainly than they did in the past, and more positively than people, for good reason, the police in many other cities.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here talking with Steve Early, a very influential labor journalist now writing on U.S. politics. And Steve, we're now facing an ominous problem in Oakland and in Berkeley and San Francisco and New York and in Portland. The ominous problem, of course, is the right wing. Across the country, the relations between the police and the left have really become much more poisonous over the last several years, and Trump's Republican Party is aligning with the violent far right, and the violence, of course, is against the left. The alt-right is courting the police, and they have a good deal of success in many cities like Portland.
You know, when civilians and police department personnel are on the same page, you get a much stronger united response to problems like hate crimes. I mean, we've had a couple of incidents in Richmond in recent years involving threats of violence against a member of the Sikh community, someone connected with the Muslim community in Richmond. And in both cases, not only was there a very aggressive and effective police investigation, prosecution of those responsible, but a rallying of the community to show people that the community was on their side, and police leadership showed up, elected leaders and other religious leaders. So I think, again, it's not something you leave to the police department or civilians alone.
That's a good model. That's the way, it seems to me, of showing these right-wing violent factions who are trying to create disorder, create fear, as well as then proclaim themselves as the forces of law and order and supporting the police, which is happening here in Portland. That's part of the good model. Portland, unfortunately, whereas the community does arise in that way, the police they've supported the alt-right against the left demonstrators and, in fact, attacked left demonstrators, mostly peaceful, maybe a few soda cans. And the police chief here, Daniel Outlaw, said on the Lars Larson show that the complaints by the left of an unprovoked police attack, she said that was just whining because we kicked their butt. Well, that's something right out of a fascist playbook. It's completely unconstitutional. It's outside the realm of police behavior.
And that was the police chief herself?
Yes, the police chief herself.
Now,
she sort of walked that back.
All I can say, in the Richmond context, it's any police officer, not to mention a police chief, was quoted publicly or in the press boasting about kicking anybody's butt. There'd be a huge uproar about that, because that is obviously not the tenor and tone that's been set here for the last 10 or 12 years. You know, prior to 2005, that was the policing style. Go out and kick as many butts and bust as many people as you can. And that's what the city's been trying to get away from for more than a decade. For police leadership to talk in those terms sends a terrible message down the chain of command to patrol officers.
Steve Early, how do we stop that message?
Well, again, I don't think it's an overnight solution, but part of the strategy of electoral change at the municipal level and electing progressives to city councils and making the mayors and getting them into positions in city government where they have the ability to change police behavior in cities like Richmond has improved policing in situations where people are exercising their rights to protest. I mean, in 6 years that I've lived here, there have been a lot of environmental protests, some involving civil disobedience, marches through the city, sit-downs. We have a number of tempting local targets, a Chevron refinery, a big rail yard, a port, lots of places where environmentalists and others in the community have gathered and engaged in protests. When the police are on a shorter leash, when they have redefined their mission, when they are accountable to the public and you have progressive municipal leadership setting the tone, it is possible to, you know, better negotiate the ground rules for how people committing civil disobedience get arrested, how the police handle situations. There's more coordination with the police, but, you know, you're not going to have that, obviously, when the police aren't trusted and when they are hostile openly to the aims and goals and politics of one particular group of protesters over another.
When the alt-right comes to a city, they deliberately sort of provoke and draw attention to themselves and demand police protection. The left, in fact, we've had some enormous rallies which have been very successful in some ways, but they've been very unsuccessful in other ways because the police and the alt-right have been able to provoke enough violence. We have to be really careful. And I think we can also reach out to the police themselves, to the police union. Most police are not brutes. They're just sort of collecting their salaries and trying to reach that 20 years for retirement. Steve, why don't you comment on that?
You know, I'm for trying to find common ground. I would not minimize the difficulty. As I mentioned earlier, you know, one of the debates in our current mayoral election this year is how much of the city budget should be spent on the police. And the progressive candidate this year, a 27-year-old African-American leader of the Richmond Progressive Alliance, who's already on the city council for the last 2 years, great community organizer, rent control advocate. He's running for mayor against an incumbent liberal Democrat. And our candidate, Melvin Willis, has called for 20% cut in spending on public safety. And you know, there's been somewhat of a backlash against that, certainly from the police union, which would, over 4 years, see a reduction in the size of its bargaining unit if Melvin was elected mayor and he implemented this program. And, of course, his opponent is trying to arouse fears among voters that the gains that have been made in violence reduction, crime reduction, would be reversed if we tried to utilize this peace dividend of community policing. So, you know, when a police union feels threatened by proposed budget cuts, by curtailment of pension and benefit coverage that's been negotiated over the years through collective bargaining, it's pretty easy to get into an adversarial situation that pits not only the police against elements of the community, but sometimes the police against other public employees working for the same city.
The issues are really complex. It seems to me it is possible to build a strong pole within the police and reach out to them in some ways to make sure that when a crunch comes and the right begins trying to organize a takeover of the state, that the police remain constitutional. I believe we have a strong position, actually, because we have a huge amount of public support for that, but we have to be able to mobilize it and not allow this dynamic of police hostility to the left to continue. Steve, why don't you take the last word?
Well, I mean, Richmond and was one of the first cities in the country to declare itself more than 10 years ago to be a sanctuary city, and that, of course, you know, has implications for local policing, positive ones, in my view. If, you know, local police are cooperating with a crackdown on immigrants conducted by federal officials, it undermines their ability to rebuild trust and confidence. And, you know, immigrant community members won't report crimes, and whatever gains you're making towards community policing will be unraveled. So at least here, the police department, I'm not sure every member of it, you know, is in favor of this policy, has for more than 10 years, you know, been told you don't cooperate with people who are rounding up immigrants and trying to send them off to detention centers. So even the initiative Sanctuary Cities, I think, is one way of weaning, if that's possible, local police forces away from being in total lockstep with others in our society, certainly in the Trump administration, who want to take a much more militarized approach to public safety as they define it.
Steve Early, thanks a lot for talking to us. Keep up the good work in Richmond. Let's hope that example universalizes across the country. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, if you visit Santa Cruz, you'll find Autumn working hard, taking care of chickens in her own backyard. There's Dusty Curtis, Chester, Birdie, Gertie, and Begonia, and Leslie Curtis, Buckles, Andrea, and Vidalia. But the most special one of all I have yet to mention, their name is Hope, a gender variant chicken. Hope took the parts of gender that they like best and added some of this and that and took out all the rest. They've got a comb like a rooster and some masculine spurs, but they lay eggs like a chicken and nest like a girl. Some people think the gender's only blue or pink, but even barnyard creatures think that either really stinks. You can wear a dress and play machines all day, or wear Carhartts and boots while you do ballet. And if people don't like the clothes that you're picking, just tell them about Hope, the gender variant chicken. They've got a comb like a rooster and some masculine spurs, but they lay eggs like a chicken and nest like a girl. Hope took the parts of gender that they like best and added some of this and that and took out all the rest.
That was Hope, the Gender Variant Chicken by Bicycle Face. You can find that on their Wonders of Female Strength album at bicycleface.bandcamp.com. It's a fun song for dispelling the binary illusion that the Trump administration is trying to force through the Health and Human Services Department, move to erase genders beyond the binary and thereby protections for people who are discriminated because of that. And before that, Bill Resnick was talking with Steve Early about the police. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Halloween is in just a couple days. We're going to be reviewing a scary film later in the show, but I also wanted to remember the Women's International Terrorist Conspiracy from Hell, which was founded in October of 1968, 50 years ago. They were socialist feminists who broke off from the New York Radical Women's Group. They did guerrilla political theater, advancing the cause of women's liberation, but also connecting it to other issues of racial injustice and capitalism. They formed covens and performed hexes and zaps and other demonstrations. Religious studies scholar Cynthia Eller wrote in the 90s that the most significant aspect of witch was its choice of central symbol, the witch. By choosing this symbol, feminists were identifying themselves with everything women were taught not to be: ugly, aggressive, independent, and malicious. Feminists took this symbol and molded it, not into the fairy tale good witch, but into a symbol of female power, knowledge, independence, and martyrdom. Formed by socialist feminists led by Robin Morgan, they distinguished themselves from the radical feminists in expanding their view of women's liberation beyond a struggle merely with patriarchy, but with adjacent oppressions affecting people of color, the poor, the working classes, the disabled. Their first hex was on Halloween 1968, 50 years ago. They put a hex on the New York Stock Exchange, which reportedly the next day lost 5%. It's also said that the keyholes to the doors around the building were filled with superglue. Other actions include protesting the inauguration of Richard Nixon, protesting a bridal fair at Madison Square Gardens in 1969. A coven founded in Chicago put a hex on the Chicago Transit Authority over proposed transit hikes. And in 1970, the Washington Coven held a protest during a Senate hearing on population control. In the 80s and 90s, their activity would die off. In 2004, Silvia Federici would write a book called Caliban and the Witch, Women, the Body, and Primitive Accumulation, which expands upon the reappropriation of the history of witches for understanding where capitalist colonialist society came from, in the European witch hunts, burning of heretics, and enclosure of commons. In 2016, after Donald Trump was elected, coven started to appear again, double downing on the intersectional perspective of the original witches, connecting women's liberation with indigenous rights, with the rights of the earth, with transgender and LGBTQ dignity and rights, with defending black lives, and dismantling the white supremacist colonialist capitalist state. In Portland, they formed under the auspices of Witch PDX. You can find out about their actions in the last year at witchpdx.com.
Some people thought that the witches were bad. Some people were scared of the power they had. The power to heal and to help and to care isn't something to fear. It's a treasure to share. Who are the witches? Where did they come from? Maybe a great, great, great grandma was one. Witches were wise, wise women, they say. And there's a little witch in every woman today. There's a little witch in every woman today. Once more, who are the witches?
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Happy Halloween, a couple days early. That was Kristen Lem singing Bonnie Lockhart's The Witches. Up next, we're going to be turning to Jan Hocken and student activist Annika Main. They're going to be talking about the Giuliana versus United States case and a rally later this morning that you can go to about it. Jan?
We'll celebrate the good witches. Well, welcome to KBOO, Annika Main.
Thank you for having me.
Last week on the Old Mole, Mary Wood, director of the University of Oregon Environmental and Natural Resources Law Center, came onto the show to talk about Giuliana versus the United States government, a trial that was scheduled to begin in Eugene today on, based on a lawsuit against the U.S. Government for their failure to act on climate change. Well, Annika, you are here today to talk about this case from the perspective of youth organizers, and it is a case where the plaintiffs are all young people. So for those who have not been following the lawsuit, the Trump administration won from the Supreme Court last week, no surprise, a delay or postponement in the trial. So let's start by talking just briefly about the case, the plaintiffs and the basis of this lawsuit.
Right. So the plaintiff's goal is to effectively take legal action against climate change. So there are 21 plaintiffs currently ranging from ages 10 to 21. And the legitimate goal here is to get our CO2 parts per million down to 350 by the year 2100. Currently, we're at about 406 parts per million. That is a really unhealthy level. So the end of the lawsuit, the plan is for us to reduce these by, you know, regulating industries, making sure that people are aware of the effects of climate change. There's been a lot of talk about climate change, but obviously legitimate action by the United States is pretty limited, especially because we are not currently in the Paris Climate Agreement. So ideally this case will, you know, reach that goal of 350.
And these cases lumber along at a slow pace. And of course, the petroleum industry and many of the oil companies were listed in the complaint early on. And they have armies of lawyers kind of can often wait out the opposition. And that's been so difficult for social movements to lawyer up at the same level or to use the courts in the same way that dominant groups and corporations have been able to use the courts. And they have a very friendly now Supreme Court that will probably, even if the suit goes forward and they win, will probably be overturned by the Supreme Court. So how do you think about this strategy of using the courts in a fight that it is like David against a mega Goliath? Right.
I think it's a unique way to go about it. We've seen so many rallies, so much activism, and sadly, we really haven't seen the legislative change. And nationally and locally, I would say there's been some progress, but it's harder to document. Like with the Women's March, that's one example where millions of people marched in the streets. We didn't see any change. So I think this is a really unique way to go about it because the effects are so hard set. It's not just a movement, it's true legal action, which I think it provides a pretty high standard for what needs to be done. And I think the level of accountability is so much greater because it's law. And that's really about as strict as you can go in this country in terms of the changes you want to see. However, you know, climate change is a timely manner. It's continuing to get worse. And the fact that the trial keeps getting delayed just kind of shows the neglect on the government's part of this issue. You know, we need to solve this now. We should have solved it sooner. The action we're taking is simply not enough. So ideally, this trial will get through and we will be able to see legitimate legal change against climate.
Because the process of the suit itself, as I understand it, requires the government to present documents that show the collusion with oil companies,
right,
and documents that are not ordinarily available to the public. So I understand that's part of the strategy,
right,
forcing the hand of the,
right,
government to show what's behind the immoral resistance to addressing the climate emergency. How do you think about the organizing of particularly young people around this issue, that it is so hard for most people to get their mind around, and many adults, you know, the good parent protects their children from horrifying things in the world, and young people now are being drawn into a horror story that doesn't end when you leave the theater. How do you try to think about this issue and encourage other young people to think about something that threatens the entire life of the planet?
Well, I think there's so much hope, and that's often hard to find, especially with issues and the way that we see issues presented, is it all just feels hopeless. But I think young people come from this unique perspective of, we haven't had the weight of the world upon us for very long, so we get to choose what we focus on. And I also think...
How depressed... Well, actually, young people can get quite depressed.
Right,
but
true.
The weight of the world, in the sense that you don't feel the guilty... Maybe it's,
right,
also the guilty complicity.
We get to put
problem.
It on the people before us. But
that's right. You really screwed things up.
But
and now we have to deal with this.
Right. And at the same time, we sort of have this responsibility, right? Because there are so many things that we want to accomplish, and climate change is sort of our gateway into doing those things. So, you know, we all want to get an education. We all want to, you know, grow up and do really exciting things, but we need a planet to do that on. So I think that's really where one of the main focuses of fixing climate change comes from, is we have a responsibility to do it. And who else is going to do it but us? We have these amazing, incredible tools to create change. The introduction of social media to activism, it's a really incredible partnership. Of course, there are problems, but we believe we have the power, and we do, to have our voices really, really heard. And I think when you want power and you can command it in a way that includes everyone and is effective, people really will listen to you. I think having 21 youth plaintiffs come with this case garners so much more attention than, you know, five adults who've been continuing the movement. And, you know, adults are just as credible in the movement, but at the same time, if you...
And also have futures they're planning.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah. But if you come from a young perspective saying, you know, this is something I really believe in, I think it really commands people's attention, because there is such an idea, you know, especially with teenagers, that we don't do anything. And that's, you know, simply not true.
Mm-hmm.
At this rally today, I know that tons of youth will come, and I think it'll be really exciting to see.
And that's a rally we'll talk about again before we close. That'll be at Terry Schrunk Plaza today at 11:30. But I think there's also a moral responsibility that adults near universally feel toward the children, and that children have rights, and they're not throughout history necessarily, but there has been a children's rights movement, certainly,
right,
since the 19th century, mm-hmm, that it's children are idealized, and there's often a kind of a fantasy of childhood, a state of,
right,
innocence. But,
right,
but aside from that, there has been a recognition throughout the world of the rights of the child, and
mm-hmm,
this, I think, draws on that, the rights,
right,
to a future. You have youth throughout the world that are part of that, have been part of this movement.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say something about the global reach of the case, even though it's based here in Eugene with our Children's Trust?
Right. So climate change is a global issue, and the fact that it's sweeping across the country, you know, the Paris Climate Agreement is an international plan, and I think this is really one of those issues where the world can come together to change it. That's what's really unique about it as well. And I think, you know, you get a different perspective from everyone you talk to, even within Portland, within America. If you look to the world, the ideas that we have to solve a problem are so sweeping and broad that really it only makes sense to solve this globally. And, you know, I think a lot about how sometimes we need something really dire and drastic for people to actually work together. And even though that can be kind of disheartening, it's really, it's also really empowering to see that, you know, different countries are working together and that youth all over the world are communicating with each other. And I think that's really powerful.
There are apparently thousands of lawsuits against governments around the world. And some of you are part, and some of these groups are part of the network through the Juliana versus United States case. Is that right?
Yeah.
So you have ways of communicating mm-hmm. with each other. And so before we close, say a little bit about the rally today and what will happen. And I think the joy you bring yeah. to this depressing topic.
Right. So we will have many youth speaking at Terry D. Shrunk Plaza today from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. We'll have ways for you to continue to stay involved afterwards. And I think it's just going to be a really powerful way to hear about climate change and advocacy and what you can do.
And kids from quite an age range
right.
of youth.
Yeah, we'll have four-year-olds and college students. So please come and see this incredible rally.
Okay. It's a great way to spend Halloween week.
Right.
Yeah. So Annika Main, thank you so much for being here. You're an inspiring activist and also involved in the anti-violence, anti-gun student organizing here in Portland mm-hmm. that's also inspiring in its vision of a peaceful, more cooperative world.
Thank you so much for having me.
What do washing the dishes, having sex, and reading a bedtime story to a young child have in common? They're all activities, labor, and work that we can understand to be reproductive. By reproductive, I mean the work of making and remaking people. Most people associate reproduction with having babies, with biological reproduction. Having babies is certainly part of reproduction. But when we speak of reproduction, and specifically reproductive labour, we're referring to a lot more than that. Reproductive work is all the work that we do that makes and remakes people on both a daily basis and also intergenerationally. And like most work under capitalism, it's work that involves conflict, violence, and exploitation. One of the main reasons that reproduction involves so much conflict is that when we produce and reproduce people, we don't do so in a neutral or abstract way. Under capitalism, we reproduce human beings as labour power or as potential labour power. We reproduce people as workers. In a similar vein, if we understand gender, race, and sexuality to be social constructions rather than inherently biological characteristics, then to a large degree we become the subjects we know ourselves and others to be through washing the dishes, having sex or not having sex, going to school, not going to university, caring for others and being cared for. From this perspective, then reproduction involves a whole lot of f***ed up relationships and processes that are central to the reproduction of capitalism as a system of exploitation and domination. In this instance, reproduction seems and is very much part of the problem. That reproduction is part of the problem is especially true when we look at the history of reproduction and who it is that does the vast amount of cooking, cleaning, and caring in the world. Reproductive work has been devalued, made invisible, and feminized. In the history of our reproduction, it is women who have been and are the reproductive workers of capitalism. Of course, while this work has always been gendered, it has also always been racialized and classed. Rich women have rarely done their own dishes, cared for their own children. It is working class women and women of colour who've done this work and who continue to do so. Reproduction has a long history, a history that is as important and as profitable to capitalism as the development of the factory system and commodity production. However, reproduction has a dual characteristic, which is to say that at the same time that reproductive labour produces and reproduces the capitalist system, it also produces life and reproduces autonomous human subjects. Subjects who are capable of creating radical revolutionary change. We may be workers, but we are not reducible to the role of worker. So to put it plainly, without reproductive labour, there is no exiting capitalism. And if our desire is to exit capitalism, and we wish to do so as quickly as possible, we need an exit strategy that pays as much attention as possible to the history of how the wage and gender have been produced, and to the systems of colonialism and slavery, and the construction of the ecological world as a resource to plunder and exploit. To pay attention to all these things, it is necessary to bring reproduction center stage. It is from this perspective that we can confidently claim that we need to seize the means of reproduction and to bring the struggles, the conflicts, and the painful tensions and contradictions of reproduction to the center of our plans to exit capitalism.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was a clip from the YouTube channel of Plan C, a UK-based communist organization you should go check out. WeArePlanC.org. Well, Halloween is in a couple days, so we've decided to review a scary movie. Society is a 1989 weird horror film directed by Brian Usna. It stars Billy Warlock as Bill Whitney, a teenage boy growing up in Beverly Hills, California, part of a high society family. Bill keeps having paranoid daydreams and even hallucinations. He thinks something weird is going on in his family, as anticipation builds for his teenage sister Nan, played by Connie Danese, to be recognized as a mature and eligible member of the ruling elite, known as society. Bill tries to tell his therapist about this, but he just minimizes Bill's concerns as normal, if irrational, fears of a teenage boy. Things only get weirder when David Blanchard, Nan's ex-boyfriend played by Tim Bartel, tries to get Bill to listen to a secret recording that he made when he bugged Nan's earring the night of her coming out party. What they hear is a murderous orgy, where Nan is shared by members of society, including her own parents. He leaves the tape with his therapist, but when they listen to it the next day together, the tape has been replaced with some innocuous duplicate. When he asks Blanchard for another copy of the tape, Blanchard is killed at the spot where they're supposed to meet, and from that point on, Bill is sure that someone's out for him too. In the end, Bill ends up at another society party. This time, he learns the truth about society, what they are, and what they have in store for him. So, Denise, we both like this film, though it is pretty kind of obscure. I don't think I would have known about it if a friend didn't tell me about it. But when you watched it, you said that you are seeing all of these resonances with other films of the era, not strictly horror films. What are you seeing?
Well, it is interesting because most of the films it reminded me of, I haven't actually seen, because in the 80s, I was kind of busy in school, but first thing that came to mind was kind of a Breakfast Club, Brat Pack, Less Than Zero, those kinds of films, because they delve into this world of teenage angst, and society has a character at its center who has some angst for very good reason, as we find out, but he is struggling with all sorts of things that these kids struggle with in these films, which has to do with, you know, you've got your girlfriend, you're trying to become president of the school, you're a jock, you have seem to have everything right in front of you, but why don't I feel right? What's wrong with this picture? So for me, that was kind of the first resonance that it really had, was more less about the horror films and more about the films that had made the 80s kind of what the 80s were when it came to teenagers and these films that were so popular.
It anticipates Buffy the Vampire Slayer in some ways, with the teen ensemble confronting the fiendish secret of society.
Another resonance for me was John Waters, who always attacked high society and the pretense of class with a kind of grotesqueness that wasn't a horror grotesque, but it was gross. We have a character in that film that is a mother and is kind of a divine character, and her strange habit is that she eats hair. And she's actually one of the only really strange characters in the film that way. But so for me, it just brought all of these things together, the kind of Brat Pack, the campiness of John Waters, and horror.
The visual style of the horror and the hallucinations is reminiscent of Videodrome and Naked Lunch, David Cronenberg. There's a lot of imagined appendages and dislocations and creepy crawlies. In one scene, one of the characters gets turned inside out.
So this is a perfect entry for the Moles to review a film leading into Halloween, a film that's horrifying and gross and kind of strange and fun all in one.
And while the final scene has been described as a sex scene, it's not a sex scene. It's just weird. There is a sex scene, though, earlier in the film, between Billy's character and another society member who turns out to love him. You know, and that is, I think, important really in the film, because that is kind of one of the energies that we're asked to kind of like consider. What are they after in this guy?
And the society has to reproduce itself. It doesn't reproduce itself by bringing people into it from the outside. You have to be born into the society. So that's the clear delineation. And we even as viewers, I think, get a sense that Billy doesn't quite fit, even though it's made quite obvious by Billy himself, he doesn't fit. And he's talking about scratching that surface and what could potentially be unveiled.
And his therapist, you know, tries to cover over his awakening to these things by just saying, oh, these are like irrational and it's normal for you to be having these kind of coming of age feelings about alienation from your parents and society and not fitting in. There is, you know, really actually something there. His fears are real, and his hallucinations are there for us to cinematically consider how he is having these intuitions, but also it's presented as like, oh, he might just be crazy. And that's part of what really keeps the suspense going in the film in a way that's effective.
Yeah, the therapist says to him at some point, you have to accept the rules of society. And he refers to the rules of privacy, which I thought was kind of interesting way to put it. And it sets up this idea that in the midst of a decade in which you saw family drama everywhere you turned, being exposed through television and film, the idea really is that the society's greatest weapon is their privacy, their shield to keep what is really going on from view of the common folks. But in fact, in the film, we understand that the vitality of an inferior class is essential to the survival of the society. In fact, this sort of subtitle of the film is The Rich Have Always Fed Off of the Poor.
And this is, in fact, like a great science fiction trope going all the way back to Frankenstein, because the historical context of collecting the body parts to create Frankenstein was the permissibility of doing with what you want the bodies of the poor and working classes, and that in a way that was fueling the advancement of science in that narrative. And that's a very kind of similar way of presenting class entitlement. One way that this film differs is that Billy isn't collected from the outside. He is actually raised from within. And so part of the moral horror is that they would raise Bill as their son, but really they're raising them to be a sacrifice.
The Billy character, he is a jock. And often in films of this sort, the jock is really the person who is the head of the class, where all of the energy and power and status collect around the jock. But Billy has a connectedness to people. He actually has friends. He actually cares about the people in his life. He understands a disconnect between himself and his family. And society family structure is incredibly alienated and superficial.
It is, but I also think that what's implied is that there's a more functional conspiracy and community going on there, and that the dysfunction and alienation of society as like the families that we see is really more of an artifact of them integrating with the human plebs, the other species that we are to them, than implying that they themselves are inherently like without an ability to be organized enough to be ruling us and eating us.
Right. And they're singularly focused on that, because their vitality, their perpetuation requires this underclass. And in this film, it takes a particular form, being that without giving too much away, you know, there's a horror element here. So your worst irrational fears become very rational very quickly when you realize that you could be eaten. And as the film unfolds, or the characters learn that everyone's in on it, and there's no real out there. Race with the Devil was my favorite film as a kid, and it played that out really in a particular way, and using a small town, devil worshippers. I mean, it had everything. But the reality is that the characters learned that everyone was in on it. It was the sheriff, and it was the grocery store owner, and all the families, and the farmer. And, you know, there was a network there. And so on that bigger scale, in a film like Society, it plays out similarly. And what it reveals to us, or could potentially reveal to us, is that there is a large system in place for keeping people in their place.
Yeah, with the conspiracy, you are either in or you're out, which is a binary sort of like the just bourgeois versus proletariat, the patrician versus plebeian structure of society.
And once you get a glimpse of it, if you're on the outside of it, even if you think you're on the inside of it, and you get a glimpse past that surface, you have to be destroyed.
And that's exactly what happens in the final scene when Bill is brought before all of society and they tell him really how it is. We have a clip from that that we want to play before wrapping up.
What's going on?
You see, Bill, it's like this. There's no business like show business.
Yes, right. Who are you?
I am not your mother.
Jesus, Bill. You never were one of us.
Who are you?
You almost understand, don't you, Bill? You're a different race from us, a different species, a different class. You're not one of us. You have to be born in the society.
Alien scum.
No, we're not from outer space or anything like that. We have been here as long as you have. It's a matter of good breeding, really.
Alien scum!
And this, in a nutshell, though you should watch the whole movie to get to that point, is the kind of idea behind the conspiracy here. And the reference to alien scum, I think, is very clearly a nod to a lot of science fiction, but more contemporaneously, They Live, which was about an alien conspiracy to control us all. And Brian Usna is making the point that they are not outside of human society. And even though they exhibit like these strange other qualities that kind of make them like aliens, the therapist, Dr. Cleveland, says that it's a matter of breeding. And so it's not really about being separate, but about being selected.
And I think that the reason why the horror in this film works is because it provides that kind of visual, visceral representation of a social mutation that resides in this high society world. It's what horror does best. It gives you some blood and guts, but at the same time, this film reminds us, as you were saying, it's not a conspiracy. It's a force that lives right here with us.
This is Joe Clement and Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We've been talking about the 1989 weird horror film Society. Find it online, request it at the library. Well, that's all the time we have for today's Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Joe Clement. That clip, that music that you just heard, is actually a lyric from a kind of prep school, upper class private school in the UK that Denise had looked up, and we forgot to mention that. We were just talking about the movie Society. You should really check it out. Ask them to purchase it at the library because they don't actually have it right now. Thanks to Jan Hocken and Annika Main. They were talking about Giuliana versus the United States, the lawsuit to bring the government to act on climate change, and how that has been stalled, and what kind of public actions you can participate to put pressure on the government to let it go through. There'll be a rally this morning in just an hour at 11:30 at Terry Schrunk Plaza in downtown Portland, Terry Schrunk Plaza at 11:30. And thanks again to Bill Resnick and Steve Early for their discussion about the police and Steve's experiences with the Richmond Progressive Alliance, bringing some kind of accountability to their police department. There's a lot more that we need to do about policing in our society than changing at the local level, the big systems that put pressure on the police to behave in the way that they do are a lot bigger than we can find at the local level. You can tune in next week, 9 to 10 in the morning, to hear more news, reviews, and interviews from the Moles Radical Perspective. You can also go online, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Listen to past shows, share individual segments, find out what's coming up on the next show. Coming up next on KBOO is Locus Focus. Barbara Bernstein welcomes Nick Abram with Yes on 1631, the Washington initiative that would put a fee on the state's largest polluters. At 11, On the Ground Radio talks to Medea Benjamin about Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and Iran, plus voices from the Women's March on the Pentagon. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.